Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be in with you on Saturday night, always. Anytime I can be with you. Well, I don't think we're helping in this surveillance state, this global surveillance state, but we don't live all over the globe. We live here. So our national security state. How ridiculous. I predicted that before long, this 2-3 years ago, I might not be the only one. I'm the only one I heard say it. That there might be an incentive if you will let us have access to your home and business security systems, your cameras and so forth. We'll give you a little tax break for that. We'll give you a little incentive. Give you a little discount on something. Yep, straight out of San Jose, California, police would be able to tap into private video camera recordings from San Jose residents who agree to provide access to authorities under a new proposal that would expand investigators' watchful eye over the city, but is already raising Big Brother-type privacy concerns. Councilman Sam Licardo's proposal, unveiled Thursday and set to be discussed by City Council Committee next week, would allow property owners voluntarily to register their security cameras for a new San Jose Police Department database. Officers would then be able to access the footage quickly after a nearby crime has occurred. Well, that sounds like a great idea, doesn't it? By the way, Smith & Wesson decided not to sell any more pistols in California because they said, well, we want you to make your firing pin so that every one of them has an individual stamp on it so that we can link the stamp on the spent cartridge case that the moron perpetrator left lying at the scene and trace it right back to that gun. And Smith & Wesson said, well, first of all, that's stupid. And number two, it's too expensive. And I guess the third thing is, bye. So, if you don't like the surveillance state, stop buying it. We'll be right back with Professor Peter Phillips on Coast to Coast AM. Professor Peter Phillips, I'm in the mood, as is the audience, for a good old-fashioned lecture. So let's hear some more of your thoughts on the global 1% and throw a little communism in there and why that probably won't work simply because of the power of the state and the human factor there, which is like, hey, we may be communistic and we may all be comrades, but we like our nice dashes and we like our big cars and we like these fur hats. Dr. Zhivago, that thing.
Okay, I'll give it a try. I would go right back to, and this is what I do with my students in my sociology of conspiracies class, go right back to The Power Elite by C. Wright Mills. He's writing this book in 1956, and he's describing how after World War II, there's a trinity of power in the U.S. that compromised the corporate, military, and government elites in a power structure motivated by class interests and working in unison through what he called higher circles of contact and agreement. So these were private clubs, policy groups, and that sort of thing. And that was kind of state theory in the U.S. for a long time, up to 20-some years ago. We looked at, and there was a lot of argument in sociology about that and to what extent that really existed and all that kind of stuff. But it's pretty straightforward. There is a power elite in the country. Now what we look at, and Leslie Sklar wrote a book in 2000 called The Transnational Capitalist Class. It was one of the first ones to really lay that out. And he's saying that the transnational class is divided up, owners, controllers of the transnational corporations, their affiliates, and they seek less in terms of nation states and more in terms of international agreements through the WTO, international institutions, the World Bank, and that. And then in 2008, David Rothkopf wrote a book called The Superclass, and he worked for Kissinger. And he called the book the Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. And this is a superclass, 6,000 to 7,000 people, 1/1,000th of 1%. They're the Davos-attending, Gulfstream, private jet-flying, money-encrusted mega corporation, interlocked, policy-building elites of the world. They're the people at the peak of global power pyramid. And they are the ones that set the agendas at NATO, the World Bank, the WTO, the G8, the G20. And they also involve shadow elites. People, these are some of the highest level people in finance, corporations, the government, the military. Basically what Mills was talking about 60 years ago, but now we're talking transnationally. And they're also shadow elites, so the deep politics of national security organizations, the CIA, in league with the drug cartels, 8,000 tons of opium from the U.S. war zones, going through $500 billion, going through transnational banks, half of which are based in the U.S. So if we look at this state, national security state, go back to World War II, I mean, before that, all we had was military intelligence and the FBI. But, you know, the OSS was created during World War II, and it became a central intelligence group in 1945, and then we passed the National Security Act, which created the CIA. And so the CIA in 45 was about 2,000 people. By 1955, it's 15,000. Today, their numbers of employees is classified. If you go to their website, they won't tell you. But there's estimates that the 19 intelligence agencies now operating in the U.S. Employ in excess of 100,000 people directly, and then there's hundreds, tens of thousands more contractors and that. So there's millions of people with high security classifications. So Eisenhower, of course, warned us about that when he described the military-industrial complex to be concerned about that. Because they were getting too powerful, and that's what Kennedy, John Kennedy, was particularly concerned about. He was talking about breaking up the CIA. And Roberts, you know, Attorney General, they were meddling in the CIA and the intelligence agencies, and he didn't go along with the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he was trying to negotiate the troop withdrawals from Vietnam. And so there's pretty good reason that structurally, for a lot of reasons, that that's why he was assassinated. And his brother was assassinated. That this elite, you know, these elites inside the national intelligence agencies were concerned about him reversing the idea of a permanent military-industrial growth capabilities. So that's part of it all. And so when we look at that, you know, now today we have, you know, the banks being the core of the transnational corporate class, trillions of dollars. They assist the richest 1% in hiding their wealth. So one of our stories in our Censor 2014 book this year is how the richest global 1% hide trillions in tax havens. So the chief economist of global management consulting firm McKinsey and Company talked about how the banks for international settlements, the IMF, the World Bank, help the 1% hide some $30 trillion. And if that money was, you know, available to governments to tax, the income on that, it would be hundreds of billions of dollars. So the rich hide their money worldwide. And so countries can't even find them or get to them. And a lot of those are right from here in the U.S. We've got the wealthy hiding their wealth. And then they complain about the taxes they do have to pay. And what who really gets taxed is working people, because we're really the ones paying for all of this, including the Social Security system, which is paid for by people, you know, paying out of their wages. The Social Security and the elites don't have to pay anything other than their company's share of that. So, I mean, it becomes everything benefits that 1% globally and those in this country, and they're taking us to the cleaners.
Yeah. You know, they don't call this fellow savant for nothing. He was reading my mind. Someone, a guest on the program, and for the life of me, I can't remember who it was, suggested that we are deliberately being postured into being the villain, the bad guy of the world. But I'm not so sure that we are, that it is some sort of a contrivance. So I'll just rather make a statement, I'll ask a question. Have we become the villain of the world?
Are we the evil empire?
Yeah.
In many ways, a lot of people in the world see us that way. The diabolicalness of drone warfare. I mean, imagine this. You know, the silent airplanes flying above us, able to rain down death and destroy whole villages at any given time. Some supposed intelligence operations that are going to identify people who are resisting. People resist occupation. People resist foreigners in their land. This idea that there's a global terrorist. I mean, Hitler called the resistance fighters in Europe terrorists. All the front pages would say the terrorists have attacked again. So are we approaching levels of that kind of mentality? Certainly we're doing some very awful things in the world, but we are not awful people. We have a military elite, and we have a transnational corporate class that just tries to get richer. And they make decisions that have negative impacts on people everywhere in the world, including here. So that's not a good thing. And that's where we have to democratically say no and stand up. And I don't see us doing that violently in any fashion. We just have to mobilize and say, we're not going to cooperate with this anymore. I'm not going to do it.
Peter, are we too late on all of this? And let me tell you why I say this. I'm just connecting some dots. I've got some dots up on the canvas. I'm drawing a picture. I'm looking at full spectrum dominance right here, with dashes in between the words, one of my very favorite news sites. And a Turkish minister has stated that over 40 Turkish Air Force pilots have resigned, but in the last 2 years, F-16 and F-4 pilots have resigned, 300 of them. And he also stressed that the resignation of these pilots has led to a personnel shortage in the Turkish Air Force. Now, combined with this is flying robots called nano quadrotor drones will deal with emergency situations of whatever configuration or nature you might imagine. That's going to be the next step, is swarms of drones. So even if the military said, no, I'm not doing it anymore. Just like they're agreeing to pay, the government has offered $200,000 for fighter pilots to stay in for another 9 years. $270,000, I think it is, over 9 years. Because our pilots are leaving. Everybody's getting sick of it. First it was 11 years of Vietnam or whatever it was. Yeah, about 11. What, 64 through 75. And now this thing in the Middle East. So, I mean, do we have any control over this, even if we do say, we're not doing this anymore, we're not going to join up, we're clearly not fighting for our country, we're fighting for that bank over there? Exactly. I mean, has this thing just taken on a life of its own? Is there any stopping this?
Well, the more we can talk about this, the more we can be openly acknowledging what's going to happen. It's like the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, the TPP, that are going on right now. That's not to benefit anybody here. That's just to benefit elites and their corporations and their continued concentration of wealth. The more we recognize that, and we don't let them pull the wool over our eyes, and we can continue to speak out about this, and we can right now. You have this program. I can talk on it. We can say what we believe and be and truthful about it. You know, we're not calling for the violent overthrow of the United States government, which sometimes the Communist Party does.
Right.
We're talking about the transformation, democratic, social transformation, to back to our original understandings of what this country was about, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, what's right. I support the Constitution in a very open way. And I think that most of the patriots in this country do. And what we're dealing with, this idea that, you know, they can build a police state so powerful that every, you know, camera in the world is watching you all the time and your cell phone's a tracking device. You know, there's millions of us that build a consciousness that the 1% are ruining everything, and we can change it. And we're not going to, you know, put them in prison. We're just going to take their power away. And we do it very democratically.
You know, I'm thinking this mainstream media is pretty much over with. I think they'll hang on for a while. But I mean, when you've got stuff like, and I'm not just picking on them because they're left, and they clearly are, but that MSNBC host the other day that interrupts somebody talking about NSA spying to go to Justin Bieber is throwing up because of because he's been partying too much. He's been arrested now. I mean, how do you adjust the mentality of a civilization that just, you know, winds up staring at it like Larry Fine in a Three Stooges deal? with that blank look on his face, just nodding, while we go from your privacy and every aspect of it is being violated. But wait a minute. Hold on. Justin Bieber has committed another boo-boo. He's in trouble. He's 19 and he's smoking pot and all that. I mean, what is this? People seem to be more fixated on sports and what, Snooki's doing than the fact that they have no privacy. They have no rights. I mean, one by one, they're being eliminated from their lives. What do you do about this?
Well, we have a new movie out called the Project Sense of the movie, The End of the Junk Food News, Reign of the Junk Food News, and that's what it's about. It's about trying to put real news back into what we see and hear. And right now, corporate media is absolutely a waste of time. It's great. I like watching the 49ers play. But most of the news, most of it's just simply entertainment. And they won't address very serious issues, and they won't talk about anything that smacks of a conspiracy, because conspiracies are too real. Even Congress came out in 78 and said John F. Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy.
Right. Did we just lose him? Because I don't hear anything.
Well, we can't go there. Well, we got to go there. We have to address these hidden in the closet, these old stories. And 9/11's full of it. A building falling down, a steel frame building falling down at the free fall speed, never hit by anything other than had some fires in it. Steel frame buildings don't fall down from fires. They never have, except that day.
How about Building 7 when the BBC gal is giving a story talking about Building 7? It's like,
it's going to fall down. It's still standing there.
Wait a second. We just lost her. Okay, knock the building down. Okay, bring her back. I mean, and nobody did anything about it.
No, I mean, the contradictions of 9/11 are just amazing. And people throw labels at you just like they did to Mark Lane and everybody else who talked about the Warren Commission report. And they've been doing that for 60 years. Challenging, saying, "Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist," meaning you're mentally ill,
right?
And that's absurd. I mean, we can think and act about issues on a very open basis and talk about them, look at the facts, and come to our own conclusions. 2,000 architects and engineers now have a serious problem that Building 7 fell down from a fire. It didn't. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks have a real problem with the 16-foot hole in the Pentagon. That a 757 was supposed to have hit. I mean, there's these contradictions that are amazing.
The
money that flowed into it, and none of the 19 hijackers have been ever. We've never seen pictures of them getting on the airplanes,
right?
Except Mohammed Atta getting on the plane in Portland, and then within 2 hours they had the list of these 19 guys who supposedly did it. That's one of the problems with these state crimes. They come up with the who did it really fast because they want to be right there. It was Lee Harvey Oswald. It was, Saran. It was these 19 guys run by Osama bin Laden. And they come up with it right away. There's some consistencies in what happens here.
Yes, yes, indeed. All right. Well, we've still got a good bit of time left, so let's do our break real quick and let our beloved sponsors entertain us with some very intriguing and interesting commercials, and then we'll discuss this national security state and anything else the good professor would like to get into as we make our way into Sunday morning, or whatever you're making your way into it, depending on when you're listening to this program. Wake up, there's more to come. This is Coast to Coast AM. Yes, it might be time for us to issue a statement to the world that, look, it's not us. It's really not us. It's like, wasn't it Belushi in Animal House who said, "Hey, you screwed up. You trusted me." And maybe that's exactly what happened to us. Maybe we just trusted that mom and apple pie and the stars and stripes waving up there, and we're going to stand up for truth, justice, and the American way, like they used to say on the old Superman series, the George Reeves. Yeah, I remember that. I used to watch that show when it was current. What does that tell you? All right, we'll be back with our final segment with Professor Peter Phillips. It's a fascinating conversation tonight. Got a couple of more questions. Maybe they'll be incisive ones. We shall see. This is Coast to Coast AM. Professor Phillips, what do you make of this this ongoing rolling national security state, replete with all of the surveillance and everything else? How do you get around that? Do we need a massive Icelandic-esque uprising? You know, they jail their bankers, they seize their assets, they roll everybody's.
They're good news, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm telling you, they set an example for the world.
Right.
Yep.
And people down the Bolivarian Revolution is doing very similar things down in South America and Central America, whereby the people are, you know, deciding from bottom up who's going to be president and how we're going to deal with these transnational elites, some in our country and those outside. And like Ecuador is, you know, allowed nature now the right of life. And, you know, it's a lot of things that are very, very fundamental that not just human beings, but any animals and things have a right to life. And that's in their constitution. So what we're faced with in the U.S., being the literally the best entertained, least informed society in the world.
Right.
Neil Postman called us that 15 years ago, is that we have literally a truth emergency. And we've written about this concept of truth emergency on a number of occasions over the past several years. We actually had a truth emergency conference in Santa Cruz a few years back, and people came in from all over the country to speak, all over the world. And, you know, what we're looking at here, when I first got involved with 9/11 issues some 13 years ago or more now, people kept saying, well, they did this, they did that, you know, and I said, well, we got to put some parameters on they. And we did a study called the Global Dominance Group, and it's published in 9/11 American Empire Intellectuals Speak Out by David Ray Griffin and Peter Dale Scott. And our research looked at who are the people that were advocating for the U.S. military domination of the world. Of course, it was Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics and Raytheon and the people in Northrop Grumman, Halliburton, those companies. But also inside of the U.S., there's very kind of neoliberal, neoconservative core of people that we're able to identify. And so we identified a couple hundred of them. We published their names in a book. We said, well, look, if this is who you really want to find out what went on, those are the people we'd want to ask. Those are the people we'd want to subpoena and you know, have a truth commission, have a reconciliation. None of that will happen under the current, you know, political parties that are both corporate parties unless there is some major movements within this country that allow for people to, you know, address these issues in a more open, dynamic way. And we have to continue to address the state crimes against democracy. There's plenty that we know about for sure. Certainly, even World War II was, you know, the number of people now say that we were manipulated into that war. McCarthyism was a fabrication of a conspiracy theory by communists that led to massive repression in this country. The Gulf of Tonkin got us into Vietnam, where Johnson and McNamara falsely claimed that we were attacked by North Vietnam, and we weren't.
Right.
Daniel Ellsberg's office was burglarized. That was a conspiracy. The Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, the election in 2000. The election in 2004. But a lot of people don't think George Bush ever won an election. Both those elections were manipulated, and millions of votes were changed in the voting machines. The exit polls tell us that, statistically. So, you know, those are state crimes. And there's many more. You know, the October surprise at the end of Carter's thing, who shot George Wallace, the reasons for that, the anthrax mailed to Senator Daschle and Patrick Leahy, of course, King's assassination, Building 7. These are all state crimes against democracy, long histories, a public record, academic research that, you know, makes us suspicious. But what we don't do is start to put it all together and put it in a context of a state crimes that are perpetuated by intelligence agencies in cooperation with shadow elites in a deep political process. And the scholar that's greatest on this is Peter Dale Scott. His books on Kennedy and 9/11 and deep politics are pretty much my thinking along the lines of there's operation, there's agency inside of these bureaucracies that helps make these things happen.
Yeah.
And we can find it. We can find out. But if we just simply ignore it, say, oh, that's crazy, our government would never do that, then we're naive as can be.
I'm not trying to put you out on the clothesline here, but what is the second step? The first step, of course, is to become aware of what's actually happening to us. And then what?
Public education is certainly the first step. Putting legitimacy to these kinds of scholarly legitimacy to, you know, conspiracy theories and the major questions of the assassinations and election fraud and all the other things we faced with on a regular basis, and not just allowing elites at the highest levels of government to investigate Benghazi and not tell us the whole truth.
All right. Then let me ask you this. Are we headed toward a socialist and eventually with a sufficient collapse of our economy? Are we headed toward a Soviet-style communist scenario in this country?
If you mean a totalitarian state, then it, obviously a police state approaches those levels. It's certainly totalitarian for people in the poorest neighborhoods in this country with stop and search and the several hundred police shootings annually of mostly people of color, 2.5 million people being imprisoned in the country. That's pretty repressive. But for white people living in suburbs and some people with means, we still have it pretty okay. They're not breaking down the doors. Could they approach that level of breaking down the doors? It may very well can, particularly if our bank accounts don't work. The banks close and there's national holidays, like what happened in Argentina. When there's economic collapse at that scale, then it gets very repressive. And then, yes, we would see a totalitarian martial law state.
Yeah, complete with nobody has any money.
All over the world. Why are we?
Yeah. Well, complete with nobody has any money. You have the jackbooted thugs in uniform. And, you know, a lot of these guys, there's some good guys out there. You know, we got into that whole...
Absolutely, and they're just fine. But we have to prevent that. We have to know that that's an inevitable scenario in our society and not blame, you know, immigrants or, you know, people in other parts of the world, but blame our own elites for getting us into this mess. It's a very small number of people that are managing the trillions of dollars of wealth and hiding it. That wealth can be shared in a more open way. I think taxation should be like it was when it was first set up. Our income tax, it had a progressive tax. These were the people that made the most, were taxed the most. That's been reversed.
Yeah, you remember when we were kids, when you and I were kids, tax on $1 million was 900 grand.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was.
But now who's paying it? It's working people paying it all. And elites have gotten away with it. I mean, a person making, say, $75,000 pays more income tax as a percentage of income than a billionaire. And the people that pay the most in taxes are the poorest. Because so many taxes are flat rate, whether it's gas tax or electric utility taxes, everything, sales tax, that affects every people, but poor people disproportionately. So the most heavily taxed people in the country are the poorest.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us like to have to pay those amounts to the government, especially when we know that half of it's going to military to kill people and you know, brown people in other parts of the world.
I'm thinking this is going to require eventually some civil disobedience. Just thinking, not advocating. Well, you know, nobody wants to get into trouble, right?
Non-cooperation. We can... make whatever decision. It doesn't matter what we do. It's when we start to do it in unison, where 5-10% of the people are really involved. I mean, if we go back to the revolution, you know, really only 10% of the people in the country supported Washington. And he was the richest guy in the country at the time, had the most to gain and the most to lose, probably, from the revolution. And 10% of them actually supported the British, and the rest of them sort of looked around to see which way it was going to go.
Yeah, that's right.
Social movements can be engaged at, you know, just a few percent of the people. But they're pulling back the covers off the elite. So when, you know, the whole Occupy movement, the mantra that it left us, the 1% mantra, gave us all a different consciousness. So people know when you say that, what that means. And our research has been trying to put some, you know, names to those figures. You know, and looking at this not just here in the U.S., but as a transnational phenomenon. Because we are a global economy.
And yeah,
we want to value and encourage human rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we all are signature to. I teach that in every class I do.
But who watches the watchers? Who guards the guards?
Who guards the guards?
Yeah.
I mean, now, or would it be in the future?
Well, I mean in our immediate future, because it seems to me, I mean, Professor Phillips, it seems to me like we're faced with an array of problems here. Everything from environmental problems, this ridiculous nuclear leak in Japan, this collapsing banking system, an unbelievable surveillance state that just is, I mean, this thing is just increasing in intensity almost exponentially. Every day it's something new. Now it's like, well, the soldiers aren't
plates. They can follow us around anyway. Yeah, it's massive.
Oh, it's unbelievable. This police officer out of North Carolina called one night on one of the lines and said, look, I'm paraphrasing him, but he was like, would you like stop trying to equate us with the NSA? It's like, well, can't really. It went up to the Supreme Court. I don't know if the decision has been made yet, but the Supreme Court was going to take up whether or not a police officer can just suck all the data out of your cell phone during a routine traffic stop.
Well, they can take all your data in your computer top when you go through Homeland Security at an airport.
Well, yeah, and they cut that Canadian lady off because they had her medical records and said, no, you've been treated for clinical depression, so you can't come in. You have to pay about $500 and have an American doctor say it's okay for you to come in. So in the meantime, you're going to miss your cruise.
I hadn't heard that one.
No, it's ridiculous. I mean, that really happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a formula for what it's going to be in the future.
Yeah.
But I trust people that they want to make what's best for themselves and their children and their grandchildren, that we can do this together, and that we have to put our thumb on the elites and say, enough. We've got to change environmentally, and we have to change politically, and we need to quit having so many state secrets and be far more transparent about what's really going on. And we'd really like the CIA to release the rest of the documents on the JFK assassination.
Oh, yeah, that'd be nice. We're not going to get into this right now, even though we do on the show all the time. But, you know, people are beginning to think that, and I'm one of them, that maybe some of this, between the unbelievable apathy of the citizenry and the brazen antics of the power elite, it suggests that some of this is perhaps being imposed on us like in an off-planet manner. I mean, where is the wonder? Look, they just photographed the coordinate. I gave out the coordinates last weekend on this Google Moon, spotted this triangular-shaped craft, which my own mother saw back in like 70 or 71, heading down the road toward Carswell Air Force Base, big as a football field, maybe bigger. So there's a picture of this thing up there with the little seven white-looking discs on the angles of the it doesn't really look like a complete triangle. It looks more like an acute T-square. So it's not quite a T. It's more like a V-square.
I don't know where we are with extraterrestrials. But the minute I start to think, well, that's crazy, then I go, wait a minute now. We have to look at what evidence is available.
Well, yeah.
The facts are, and I know that the Disclosure Project really came up with some really interesting stuff. So it's not something I've studied, but I'm certainly not afraid to talk about it or look at it. But we, you know, all everything has to be on the table. Anything else is censorship.
Well, you know, the only reason that I brought that up is because what the hell has happened to any sort of a sense of philosophy? I mean, wasn't philosophy originally the study of what makes a good life? And it seems almost as though the civilization, except for the ones that are worried about where they're going to get their next dirt clod to feed themselves with that night, I mean, that whatever your problem is, whatever your biggest problem is as an individual, that's your biggest problem. And if it's just like getting through the night with some food in your belly, that's your biggest problem, and that's a big problem. But what has happened to the pursuit of the good life? It's almost as though we have turned into a masochistic society that just wants to see how much we can suffer, just see how much we can take, and then we'll flip out and try and do something about it.
Well, you know, I teach at a university, and we're a state college. And, you know, but I've watched over the last 20 years that I've been here, that's sort of the continued privatization, top-down control, you know, college presidents, you know, kind of given up on the idea of shared governance, that they pay lip service to it. But the reality is presidents control these institutions. And, you know, so I watched the California's trustees of we're the largest university system in the country. I watched them, you know, 12 years ago declare that if you build a new building, you can only name it after a private donor. You can't name it after Robert Louis Stevenson. That's only a temporary naming.
Right.
I mean, you know, that sort of mentality, and the trustees, which are appointed by the governor, are part of the elite that continue to have this privatization process. Not only, you know, and it's part of what No Child Left Behind was about, is control. Educational control, and take it right up to the universities. Thank God we still have some tenure protection in some of the universities, but most of the teachers teaching now are lecturers and part-time around the country. And, you know, I can do courses. I can speak out about this. And I've got a union of 25,000 so that I can say these things and not worry terribly about, you know, being repressed in the office. But, you know, that's not always the case in all universities, and it's something that, you know, we have to have. But freedom of speech is, you know, it was number one on our amendments.
Yep.
That was really important.
Yes.
Our ability to speak out and talk about issues and debate and have, you know, open conversations and not be afraid to talk about things. That's really important. And I watch these privatization of these universities going on. I mean, our university, they built $150 million concert hall.
Right.
Where Sandy Weill, who was the head of Citibank, gave the last $12 million to help put it together. And it's a concert hall, not for students. I mean, they can attend when they rush tickets at the end, but it's for the regional elite, for symphonies and all of that. I mean, so now we're a second-tier state university with this world-class concert hall that's going to have us in debt for the next 30 years. I just watched this happen, and it's just amazing. And you know, you can see it on your own scale anywhere, and then you have to deal with it on a global scale with the 1%.
Professor Phillips, you have been a marvelous first-time guest, and I predict you will not be a last-time guest. Hope you'll come back and speak with us again. Yes, it has. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
His book is Censored, Media Democracy in Action, and the website is projectcensored.org. You should check it out. All right, we'll make our way into the next couple of hours with the one and only Matt Stein. His book, When Technology Fails, and his other book, When Disaster Strikes. We'll be back. This is Coast to Coast AM.